bomb a 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 dang a dang dang a ding a dong.
Blue moon, blue moon, you saw me standing alone.
Hello and welcome back to the Railway Men podcast. We are back with a special episode. To help me along the way today, I have Tim Robinson. Hello, Tim.
Hi, Stu.
But I'm also joined by Crew Alexandra midfielder Jack Powell. Hi, Jack.
Hi, mate. You all right?
All good. Thank you. Thank you so much for jumping on with us today.
No worries.
We normally start these pods by asking people what they remember about the game, when they realise how good they were to make it as a career. But I think I'm going to make an exception with you today, Jack. First question I think most Crew fans listening are going to want to know. How's the knee and how's the recovery process going?
Yeah, it's not too bad. It is a very slow process. It's one of those things that you can't really speed up. So it's a little bit frustrating at times. I suppose when you get like a muscle injury or you get a knock, there's always things that you can do to kind of speed up the process, like I said. But this is one where you kind of have to be patient. So yeah, off the back of having the surgery about 5 weeks ago now, it's coming along as expected, really. So no hiccups at the moment. It's healing well and improving by the day. Yeah, so all good at the minute.
Are you up to walking around yet, or a bit of swimming, or on the bike, or is it?
I'm in quite regularly at the club, and I'm doing a fair amount of body weight stuff. So yeah, I was on the move after a couple of weeks or so, really. And it's like little checklist things, really, like kind of getting back to driving and things like that, just kind of going about your everyday life, which you don't realize you kind of is going to be taken away from you. So I have a couple of weeks post-op at home, just kind of bed bound, really, a little bit. But with the way that my life's set up and the dynamic that it's got, I kind of had to get back on the move probably sooner than most would have, really. But it's probably been a good thing. It's been beneficial that I've been on the move more, because a lot of it is to do with movement. A lot of the recovery is movement. A lot of like getting the swelling down and things like that is to do with movement. So yeah, I'm fully on the move, still not able to kind of get full mobility in my knee at the moment. So it is a little bit restrictive, but yeah, I'm kind of back amongst it, if you like.
That is tremendous to hear. From a selfish point of view, I'm going to ask you, have they given you a time frame about when you're back on the pitch?
It's difficult, really. It's kind of like the surgeon will always say 9 months from the operation date. So I've done the math myself plenty of times, and that's August the 24th. But obviously that's building up to being back fully fit and playing. So it's been said that it's kind of 7 to 9 months generally, but the more you leave it towards the 9 months, the less chance you've got of re-injuring. So even at the top level, you'll see obviously players come back from injuries in miracle amounts of time, because of the facilities and obviously what they've got available to them, doctors, all that kind of thing. But even with the ACLs at the highest level, people will still wait 9 months just because of the risk of re-injuring. So a realistic goal that I've set myself is to be fully fit and ready and able to be selected for the first game of next season, which kind of shaves a couple of weeks off the 9 months. But, you know, I want to be sensible in one sense, but also I'll be itching to get back at that point. So I'd like to be fully involved in pre-season and be available for selection first game of next season.
That is great to hear. Just going to the injury itself, if you don't mind, the Stockport game, you seem to know straight away, like there was a reaction that people picked up on that, oh, this is serious. Is that the case? Did you know straight away that something wasn't right there?
Not particularly, just because I haven't really been injured. And it's always the same thing. If you get like a little bit of muscle tightness or anything like that, you're always trying to probably think back to what you might have done in the past. And where I hadn't been injured really in the past, well, I had an MCL tear on the other side of my leg, on my other leg, sorry, a couple of years back, and the discomfort was similar. So I sort of knew that I had done something, but I just didn't know how severe it was. And me being me, as I did, I tried to get up to my feet and kind of hop on it and just see if I could play on, and maybe just thought it was just like a temporary thing. And then when I made my way over to the edge of the pitch, I knew that something wasn't right. But yeah, like you do testing straight after you have an injury like that, and it's whether you test positive or negative for certain tears within the knee. And I didn't actually test positive for the ACL tear. And we were hoping it was going to be something more like a meniscus tear, which would have been minor in comparison. So when I got results back, it was a little bit of a shock to everyone, really. So yeah, I wouldn't say I fully knew. I knew that there was discomfort in my knee. I wasn't in a massive deal of pain. Like a massive deal of pain at all. So yeah, I don't really know. It's difficult for me to say just because I haven't really suffered many injuries in the past. I did compare it to my other leg, like I said, and it was a similar discomfort, but obviously turned out to be a lot worse than what I've had in the past.
He reported it as a rupture in the on the club website, which is with Mountain, it's the worst type of tear. It's all the way through. So with that, do they have to take a bit of hamstring or something to repair it? Is that what they still do?
Yeah, so you have two options, really. You have a patella graft, which is obviously your patella tendon, and then you have the hamstring graft. And the surgeon that I saw, who's been really good, basically said that he does usually side with the patella graft, and it makes it a little bit more difficult with mobility and stuff after the operation. But everyone that I spoke to that had like either the hamstring or patella graft had said that they had no problems with their patella graft and always kind of had issues with their hamstring after getting the hamstring graft. So he wanted to do a patella graft. Obviously, at that point, you have to put your trust in people who know better than you. And yeah, they took the tendon from my patella, or part of the tendon, and then reconstructed a new ACL from that. And then you also get something called a tenodesis, which is like an additional ACL, if you like. It's like getting yourself from having one to having none to having two, which is like an extra bit of stability, really. So yeah, I've got a couple of scars, one down the front of my knee, one down the side of my knee. And that just gives you that extra bit of protection.
Okay, we're going to move on. We'll come back to this season later, but as we normally do, we'll go to the start of your career. Now, you're from Canning Town, I discovered when I was doing my research. So I presume, and I might be putting my foot in it here, West Ham is your team?
Yeah, all my family are West Ham. So yeah, grew up as a West Ham fan.
And then you were briefly involved with their youth team when you were coming up. What were your first memories of football? How did you sort of realise you might be able to make a career out of it?
When you talk about memories, it's just mainly like what my parents have kind of told me about, really, and pictures that I've seen and things like that from a young age. This is like talking about like from 3 and 4, just kind of getting that obsession with football and sleeping with a football at the end of my bed and like playing with football type dolls and things like that, wanting football kits, pretending to be Paul Gascoigne and things like that. And I think that was more from an England perspective. My dad used to say, I used to run around and say, I'm Gazza. And it's strange, really, because I didn't see an awful lot of Gazza and don't really remember a lot of Gazza. But they're the things that obviously you get told as an adult from your parents. So that they're probably like the earliest memories. And then it was getting taken to football with my dad, who played football on Saturdays and Sundays. Just kind of being in amongst the bags, like the holders on the side of the pitch in the cold, just sitting there, just watching games and watching my dad play football. So that's where it came from at a really young age, probably, yeah, like I say, from when I could walk, really. So it was just from family members that obviously had a keen interest in football, and my dad obviously playing football, taken along with him, and then that's where the obsession started, really.
Okay, let's move it along then. So you are briefly at West Ham, but then you end up at Millwall in the youth team there. How does a West Ham fan end up in the Millwall youth team?
I didn't play an awful lot of Sunday League football. in today's world, I would have started a little bit late, really. I think I started when I was 7 or 8. Kids now are kicking the ball around like for teams at the age of 5. So I played a bit of Sunday league football for a local team. And then I was picked up by West Ham within about 6 months of playing Sunday league football. And most academies then would invite you down to like a 6 week trial. I went there probably 2 times and then was asked to join the academy. Spent 11 years at West Ham from the age of 8 until 19. Did 1 year as a professional, and then I was told that I wasn't my contract wasn't going to be renewed, so I was being released. Which probably was a little bit of a shock, really, because I'd sort of always been doing quite well, and I think you get sort of stuck in a bit of a bubble that, West Ham fan, been there for a long time, going to get the opportunity to play in the first team. And it just didn't really work out, and just part and parcel of football. Then obviously was told that I wasn't going to stay, and then I had a host of clubs really offering me trials and things like that. And I think what happened was, if I was trying to figure it out for myself without really knowing, that people were surprised that West Ham were letting me go. And as a result of that, maybe there was a question mark over me, like why are they letting him go? And they wanted to see me rather than offer me a contract directly from leaving West Ham. So a lot of these clubs wanted to see me. And I went and trialled up and down the country at various different clubs, probably double figures in the end across my career. And it was tough at the time, but I just always had this confidence that, the right club will come along. And then Millwall offered to have a look at me and train there a few times and offered me a contract till the end of the season. So I just grabbed it with both hands, really. I didn't really think about the West Ham and Millwall kind of connection and that. Obviously, I've been brought up to think Millwall was this particular type of club as a youngster, being a West Ham fan. And then you go there and you just realise, that there was a lot of good people at that football club, and it was a time that I really enjoyed. So that's how it came about, really. It was just really me just wanting to pursue, obviously, my career in football. And I didn't really look at them like rivals. I just see them as another opportunity to develop as a footballer.
I read on the one of the Millwall fanzines that on your league debut for Millwall, you played 80 odd minutes, got taken off for 10 to go, got a standing ovation, and they gave you the nickname Peckham Perlow. Is that how you remember that day going? It must have been pretty good.
Yeah, it was a great day, really. I built it up from having a couple of Carabao Cup appearances. I came on as a sub and then started against Southampton, and they were in the Premier League at the time. They fielded a really strong team, and I played really well. And then the manager decided to start me a few days, or maybe like, I think it was a few days later in the league. But it was probably our next league match. So I started the next league match, and yeah, it was everything that you kind of would imagine it to be growing up, wanting to be a professional footballer. Obviously, in the league and starting off in the Championship was a good place to start. Yeah, and it was almost like a dream come true, really. Like, it was a good crowd at the Den. I set up a goal on my debut, played really well. So yeah, obviously the nickname came from that day, and I get asked about that a lot now. I think Peckham, obviously being an area in South London, and then just my style of play. Not sure, might have done Perlo a little bit of a disservice, but I'll take it.
Yeah, I don't think it's not a nickname to be sniffed at. From there, though, I presume you probably thought you were going to kick on from that, getting a standing ovation league debut. It didn't really seem to happen for you at Millwall, though. Why was that, do you think?
It's kind of hard to put my finger on, really. Like you just said yourself, like I know it sounds a little bit like, oh, everyone would say that, but it being, like I said, a dream come true, and I played really well went on my debut, and then played really well on a few occasions for Millwall, like in that short space of time, like from the cup games to my league debut. I remember thinking to myself at the time, when people say about when you get your opportunity as a youngster at a higher level, like you really got to grasp it and you got to take it, and I felt like I did that. And then we started to lose games of football. And at the time, Ian Holloway, the manager, I spoke to him quite a lot, and I asked him for more opportunities. and he just felt that the team losing games wasn't an ideal time for me to be a part of the team. So yeah, he just kind of limited my opportunities based on the fact that he thought that, you know, my confidence might have been shot by the fact that we was losing. But obviously that wasn't really taking my career where I wanted it to go, because I was either on the bench or the 19th man traveling up and down the country. I found out at a later date that I had some loan offers, and that's something that kind of I don't really regret much in football, because I just feel like, you know, it does take a little bit of time and a little bit of luck to get where you need to go. But at that point, I probably should have gone on loan and developed my kind of career and got some EFL experience, and then that might have been the kind of what I needed really to then progress. So yeah, it was just about time, and really the manager not willing to use me in a team that wasn't doing particularly well. But I think Holloway, to be fair to him, like, he did see a longer term future for me at the club. It just wasn't at that time. And then he got sacked at a similar time where he wanted me to sign a new deal with the club. And then, yeah, it just didn't really work out from there.
So from Millwall, there's a few years in the non-league, a couple of years at Ebbsfleet and a year at Maidstone. If you were hoping that being at Millwall and breaking through there was going to be like the making of you, and, you know, the way to build your career, do you think it was those years in non-league that were, this is what I'm all about, this is Jack Powell, this is how I play football? Is it those years in non-league?
Yeah, I think so, because at a younger age, I was probably still really developing, I say, the other side of the game. Like, for me, it's the other side of the game, which is more of the defensive side of the game, being more aggressive, winning more tackles. And that's something that only games really, if that's not your natural game, only games can give you that. So I didn't play enough at Millwall to develop that enough. I spent some time on loan when I was at Millwall in non-league. And those spells were disrupted by like bad weather and games getting called off and things like that. Concord was great. But I think when I dropped down to Concord in the Conference South, I was probably in a way above the level by quite a way that I didn't really need to. Although I did my fair share of like the defensive duties, I just felt like it was not too easy because it's disrespectful, but I was above the level at that point. And then Braintree obviously was disrupted, like I said, through games getting called off, and I just didn't play as regularly as I would have liked there. And then, yeah, dropped down to Ebbsfleet after Millwall, and I had a manager that, and I think at that time I needed a manager that understood me as a player, and was going to give me time to develop the things that I wasn't particularly good at. And that was Darryl McMahon at Ebbsfleet. So yeah, obviously played like over 100 games for Ebbsfleet, and that's when you learn kind of over that period like what's required to be successful, to be consistent, and play for points every week and try and do something like getting promoted. So yeah, I'd say my time at Ebbsfleet was kind of like the base that I needed. But unfortunately, probably for my career to go where I wanted it to go, it probably came a little bit too late, because I was doing that at like 22. And nowadays, like, you want to be doing that at probably 17, 18, 19. Do you know what I mean?
Whilst in non-league, though, you did pick up some England C caps. That must have been a pretty proud moment for you. Was it three that you got?
Yeah. The games didn't really come around all that often, really. But they pick a team every so often from the best players in non-league. So yeah, I got called up to that, and it was a really good setup. That, to be honest, like, it's kind of people might look at it and think England C and think, oh, like, why is England C? But it was like the best players, and at the time they used to do the best players in non-league under the age of 23, I think it was. Now they've opened it up to the whole league, and they can pick players as old as they want to pick. So that was a good experience. Good to be a part of. Done some travelling as well. I think we went over to Slovakia and played against their under-21s. And what they would usually do is play against another team's actual under-21 setup, not their like best non-league players. So yeah, really good experience, a really kind of good setup as well. Something that I really enjoyed and I kind of look back on fondly.
Who else did you play? Slovakia under-21s and...
Yeah, played Slovakia under-21s was out in Slovakia. We played... I think it was like a select Punjab side in Birmingham. And then we played in another game. I came on as a sub, I think. I can't remember who the other team was who played. But yeah, there was like two or three appearances for them. But like I said, the games didn't really come around all that often. And then by then, obviously, my career path had kind of changed and I wasn't eligible to play for England C then.
Yeah, that is because Crawley come knocking. You're back in the Football League. Was that a big step for you? Was that sort of like a big milestone you wanted ticking off back in the EFL?
Yeah, I think so, because I remember looking back on it now, like you kind of come out of the league and then you're looking for a way back into the league, and the EFL, like the league, if you like, is like the promised land, and everyone talks of it of being like a such a difficult level to play at, you know, League Two, so much more difficult. League Two is this, League One and Championship. And obviously I had a little bit of a taste of Championship football and then played once in League One for Millwall. Not that you can get much of a bearing from that, but being around the games and seeing games, you kind of learn a lot. And I did that a lot with Millwall. So yeah, like that's the way that it was spoken about. It was almost like as if, oh, you know, it's really difficult. And it is difficult to drop out of the league and then come back into the league. Just in terms of the process, I wouldn't say it's difficult in terms of it's a difficult transition. But yeah, my time was kind of up in non-league, really. I felt like I did well at that level. Obviously went to Maidstone after Ebbsfleet, because Ebbsfleet had a few issues at the time. And then I was obviously just really pleased that a league club had showed some interest in me. And I just wanted to take the opportunity with, you know, kind of whatever it took, really. So I decided to go to Crawley having some offers to stay in non-league. But like I said, I felt like I'd done my time in non-league and prove myself at that level, and I wanted to come back in the league and prove myself again, that I could be consistent in the league.
You're at Crawley for 4 years in total. Can I talk about the third year, the end of the third year, April 2022? Wagmi United take over. What's that like as a player at the football club? All of a sudden, these guys from America that have made their money in Bitcoin or cryptocurrency have said we're going to take over and we're going to get Crawley up the leagues. What's the player's response?
It was quite exciting, to be honest with you. Obviously, doesn't always go according to plan when someone wants to come in and spend money. But even if you look at the league now, like if you spend more money, the chances are that you're going to get some positive outcomes if you spend that money in the right way. So we was really excited. We felt like it was something we probably needed, because we had a good team at Crawley and we could never quite take that next step. And we were always kind of like somewhere around 10 points off the playoffs. And it was just that, you know, four or five extra wins that might get you in the playoffs 1 year. And we finished mid-table, I think, 2 years in a row. I think we finished 12th. So we were excited for that investment. And obviously, some people might look at it and think, you know, maybe my time's going to be up at that particular club. But I just saw it as, you know, hopefully we'll bring in better players that complement the players we've already got. And I thought that was the way it would go. Like we'd keep the core of the team together who had done really well for the club. And then we'd bring in some supplements that could help that team progress and get into the playoffs. And that was the plan, really, from Wagmi to really kind of kick the team on as quickly as possible. But it was a little bit strange to be. I've never been involved where a team's been taken over like whilst you're at the club. So yeah, it was a strange kind of time at Crawley then. But it was an exciting time, to be honest. It was the exciting time.
Did you see much change within like the way the club was run when they took over?
Yeah, I saw changes. I think like in terms of like the facilities we had at the time, they improved in terms of like some of the medical department and that. We had more almost like machinery to use and things like that, because there's a lot of things now like within the physio and the medical side of things that you can use now with like, you know, like the game readies, like ice machines and Normatec machines, which is like a compression thing for your legs and things like that. So they've done that, and you know, they always kind of were searching for a new training facility. So there were steps that were taken to improve the club on the whole, but a lot of it was like a recruit from a recruitment stance, and more so a recruitment stance than anything really off the pitch.
At the time you were at Crawley, as well as the takeover, I think you played under seven managers in 4 years.
Yeah, probably was a lot of managers, yeah.
From the outside, it seems like that's quite a lot of upheaval. Did it feel like that at the time?
I think, to be honest, it kind of depends where you end up within that. Do you know what I mean? I think, obviously, the first manager change benefited me to a certain extent because I wasn't playing under the first manager. I went on loan to Aldershot because of that. And I was almost signed by the previous owners rather than the manager himself. So obviously I just took that opportunity and was willing to kind of prove to the manager that I should play, but wasn't given an opportunity to do that. So the first manager change was a positive one for me, really, because I ended up playing under the next manager. And then after that is when like quite a lot of managers came in quick succession. And I experienced that a little bit at Maidstone, where we had probably 3, 4, 5 managers in the space of about 8 months. And it's difficult. I obviously haven't had positive experiences because of that. So yeah, it was really kind of disruptive when we felt like we were getting things right. And it happened in a similar way at Maidstone as it did to Crawley. Like we had an interim manager, like a caretaker manager, that we felt was getting the best out of what we had at the time, considering we were really low on confidence. And then that got changed. And then we were back to square one, kind of trying to learn like a new way of playing under a new manager and different personnel and things like that. So it was really quite disruptive, and it has been in the two clubs where I've experienced that. But obviously, like, owners are owners for a reason and they make their decisions.
The manager that you played under for longest at Crawley was John Yems. I think he was the one that you said came in after the original manager that you played under left.
Yeah.
It seemed like last summer, kind of moving on to the circumstances around moving to Crewe, seemed like there was a sort of policy of getting rid of some of the Yems era players at Crawley. Was that a managerial thing, or was it the kind of club direction of travel? And did that contribute to your move at all to Crewe, or was that something completely separate?
In a way, it probably did. Yeah, like it. I have to say, it was a mutual thing between me and Crawley in the end. At first, like I'd just been voted like player of the season from the fans, and I felt like I had a pretty good season considering we struggled most of the year, and I felt like I was a big part of the reason why we stayed up. Obviously, I've always been settled down south, it's where all my family are. So initially, like what I wanted to do was stay longer term, but I only had a year left on my contract, so I asked for that kind of extension, and the club explained that it wasn't going to be possible for whatever reason. And then from there, like, we kind of agreed that it was best for me to try and explore a different option. I still had the option to stay there, but I just felt like once I'd met with Crewe and other clubs started to become interested, it was probably best for me to move on at that point. So yeah, I think it was a bit of everything, to be honest, but I always have to kind of say that it did end up being like a mutual move in the end, really.
That's something that's confused me, you know, looking at that, because it does look, you know, from the outside that was the case. But like you said, you were player of the season. I think you played 45 out of 46 games last season. It seems an odd decision to let that player leave, to me, from an outsider's perspective.
Yeah, it's one of those. I think if you do some simple maths and you just sit like player of the season and then like moving on, like you can kind of work out why that may or may not have happened. Do you know what I mean? So like I said, I was sort of willing to stay at Crawley. I just felt like I deserved a bit more than just a year left on my contract, having a family and whatever, that's just the security side of it. It was a strange one because I anticipated that like I was going to be what I was wanted, and I don't think I was unwanted in that sense. I just, for whatever reason, the contract that I kind of wanted to stay, it wasn't possible, and it was just more a case of me wanting some more security and a longer contract, really. And it just got explained to me that it wasn't possible to do that. along with some other things that are probably better left unsaid. But obviously, I'd like to think this turned out to be for the best. And yeah, now I am where I am, and it's something that I've kind of always wanted to do. Try to live in a different part of the country and experience football in a different part of the country. And the timing just seemed right. With my family dynamic and the type of club that Crewe is, it just made a lot of sense.
This was my next question, Jack. You know, if you look at the teams you played for on a permanent basis, Millwall, South London, Ebbsfleet and Maidstone, both in Kent, Crawley, Sussex, you haven't even played north of the River Thames before. Did you get a nosebleed driving up the M6 to Crewe?
Well, the first time I came up was on the train, so it was a bit better than driving. And yeah, it was just obviously as a footballer, you travelled around the country time and time again, but you never actually spent any time there, which is a strange thing, really. You just pretty much off the coach in the hotel to the stadium, back on the coach, and back down south again. So you don't get to experience what it's like to be up north, if you like. So yeah, like I was quite looking forward to the challenge. Really, it's something that I've always, just the way that I've been, just any challenge in football, I've looked forward to. And then obviously by now I've got children and stuff, and that was probably the main priority. I always feel as though I can make the football work, just who I am as a person, as a player. But it's more the worry of whether your family will settle and enjoy it. So yeah, like I wouldn't say I had a nosebleed. Yeah, it's definitely a lot more north than I've ever been in my life, in terms of actually settling somewhere. And I wouldn't say it's been an awful lot different, to be honest with you. It's just been an enjoyable experience so far.
I was going to ask, are you and the family feeling settled then in South Cheshire now?
Yeah, definitely, definitely. Obviously, it hasn't materialised before. For whatever reason, whether that be like an offer or just timing wise, I didn't feel like it was the right time to do it. But it's probably something that I probably would have liked to have done a bit sooner, really. But yeah, I think once you get the kids into school and you get them settled and you've got family coming up to visit, which has been nice, you just feel like it's sort of like home from home, really. So I feel really settled. Kids are really enjoying it. It's kind of a different way of life and a new part of the world kind of for them to explore as well. So all the places that you can take kids out for a day have been used up down south, and now we've still got plenty more to go up north. So that's been a nice thing.
We saw one of your kids cheering on Crewe on Twitter as well. I'm glad you're bringing them up the right way anyway.
That's it, mate. Now, to be honest, they've come to a few games now, and it's just different, really. I think, you know, not being disrespectful to Crawley, but Crewe, and I'm not saying Crawley isn't, but Crewe just gives you that proper football club vibe. And obviously he's had success in the past, being at higher division and things like that. But, you know, going to a ground comes along with hearing chants and things like that. So the smallest one of the three picked it up, and I just thought it was quite funny, to be fair. And he's always running around singing it and that. So I got a couple of my boys enjoy football. So I thought it was a funny one to post.
Now, you've obviously spoken a bit about, you know, the appeal of Crewe and coming and trying something different, football in the north, etc. What did Lee Bell do to sell the club to you when those talks were going on?
I think just the way he was as a person, really. He just seemed to have a really good understanding of who I was before I'd even met him, really. And just ticked a lot of boxes, obviously being really family orientated and wanting my family to settle. He just reiterated that that would be the most important thing, that the family got on okay. And then obviously between me and him, we'd take care of the football stuff. But yeah, just really accommodating. Couldn't have done any more for me when I came up initially. And yeah, I just think the attraction of Crewe itself, like just the club it is, the facilities that it's got, that kind of everything put into one, it needs to be the kind of the whole package, really. And just a man that kind of makes you want to play football for him. Even my missus, like, she just said that it just seems like such a nice guy and whatever. And She would have been disappointed if I would have chose a different route after meeting him. And it's just that kind of personal touch, really. A lot of clubs, like, they just pretty much just contact your agent, contact yourself, and offer you a deal. But that personal touch kind of gets lost in the wind somewhere. So it was the only club that kind of gave me that personal touch, and it went a long way.
One of the things that we're told by ex-players, current players, quite a lot at Crewe is the coaching is quite a like a little bit different and possibly a level up in terms of the league that they play in. The coaching might be higher, you know, working with the young players, bringing them through. Is that something that you've noticed since you've been at the club? Is the coaching good? Is it significantly good?
I think initially, like, it's very clear that it's a coaching club, and that comes from the manager, that comes from obviously Ryan Dicker, Kenny Lunt, people that work closely to him. It's a club that obviously brings through a lot of players, especially like this season. Whereas, like, you'll be at other clubs and the manager doesn't necessarily coach. The manager pretty much just manages and leaves the coaching to his assistant or his first team coach. And I think that development of players goes hand in hand with obviously the coaching they got down the years, and that transfers into the first team. Because, you know, a few clubs that I've played for in the past will just be like, you know, we'll get experience on the pitch, and there's players that know how to play the game and play the game the way they want to play, and they're set up in a formation, and there's no real philosophy to how they do things, but because they've got good players and they've got experienced players, they'll win games of football. So I think it just transfers from the bottom to the top of Crewe, like trying to bring through players, coaching them in a particular way, trying to get them into the first team, and then continuing to coach the first team on top of that. And I think that's what Crewe does, and that's something that I've noticed. Obviously, some really good ideas, a particular way of playing just changed slightly depending on who the manager is. But it's more of a philosophy thing, and a lot of football clubs don't necessarily have that. Kind of changes from manager to manager, whereas Crewe's almost like you could relate it in a way to maybe like a higher level club that has a philosophy regardless, or they pick the manager based on their philosophy. Whereas if you see probably most League Two clubs will change their philosophy depending on their manager, and that's probably kind of instilled in Crewe, and part of the reason why I wanted to come to the club, because I felt that that partnership between myself and the club kind of made sense.
You mentioned Kenny Lunt just then. Now, Tim and I are of an age where we had the pleasure to see Kenny Lunt play for Crewe. I don't know if Tim would agree with me, but I'd say you're the person in the current squad who's got most similar attributes to Kenny when he was a player. Has he sort of kept you to one side and sort of given you some words of wisdom? I think one of the things that, again, this season we've seen a big improvement in is set pieces, which I think you've played a big part in and which he was superb at as well. So have you had any sort of like pearls of Kenny wisdom?
Yeah, me and Kenny actually talk quite regularly, to be honest. Obviously, I speak to the gaffer a fair bit, Ryan as well. But in terms of one-to-one conversations about football and particular things in football, me and Kenny probably speak the most. So yeah, he doesn't really make you aware of like what he used to be capable of or what he used to do when he played for Crewe. You hear that from other people. So he's one of those sort of people who doesn't really talk much about himself in terms of his football and stuff. But you can almost tell when you've not necessarily got the respect, but almost a little bit like you've got the admiration of a certain kind of coach. And I can tell that maybe we think in similar ways, and we used to kind of come up with set pieces just between the two of us and little things that we worked on. Or if there was a little addition that I wanted to make, he was kind of more than willing to do that. So yeah, there's a lot of things, and even there's been times when I've asked him. There'll be times in a game, for example, a particular type of player that I feel that I am, there might be an occasion where I'm almost maybe chasing a pass that is not necessarily there because I want to be progressive and make things happen and create opportunities for the team. And there'll be times when I'll say to him, you know, if I get in that kind of situation where, you know, it looks as though I'm chasing a pass, just have a word with me and just say, just keep it simple, keep things ticking, and it will come when it comes. So we had that relationship where he was able to do that for me, and we've spoken a lot about football and just about the team and things that we think we can improve on, a fair bit, to be fair.
Just on the, I've got another question actually, but just on the set pieces specifically, you've there've been a couple of nicely worked. You know, we describe them, or the commentators describe them as, you know, training ground moves.
Yeah,
I'm just interested in how they kind of how you work on them. Is it, you know, does Penny come up with an idea, or is it something you as the set piece taker would come up with, and then you sort of play it out on the training ground a few times and perfect it?
Yeah.
Or is it more spontaneous than that, and it just makes it look to us like it's a training ground move?
Well, I think if you go into the kind of detail, just looking back at some of the ones that have worked and maybe not worked, like 99% of the time, Kenny will give us an idea, and then we'll go through it on the training ground on the post. And we'll go through it a few times just to kind of make sure the timing's right and things like that, because that's kind of like one of the big keys to kind of getting set pieces right. So it's about timing. So most of the time you'll come up with them and they're good ideas, and then obviously everyone pretty much has a free rein to alter it or see how they feel within it and say where they think that they might be able to do better. It could be like a cutback corner that's going from right foot onto right foot, and usually that's easier to hit a right footed one that's coming towards a right footer to then hit a right foot shot, for example. And sometimes it might be set up with a left footer, someone like Joel Tabiner coming onto a right foot, and it's a more difficult one to hit. So it just depends how you feel within that move, and you're free to kind of say, I think it'll be better if, you know, a right foot takes this as an outswinger and it lands on a right footer. But yeah, 99% of the time Kenny comes up with them. I think we was quite successful with them, to be honest. Obviously, we scored from a lot of set plays. And then there'll be times as well where he really enjoys kind of us being spontaneous with it as well. So one we might have set up, but just mid set piece, you kind of alter it to how you think it should be, or depending on the way that the other team sets up. There was one where we scored, I think it was the equaliser against Mansfield. And usually we take out swinging wide free kicks. Me and Joel would take them so they're swinging away from the goal. And I just felt like the angle wasn't great. Played it short, ended up getting it back wide, and then crossed the ball for Rio to score. And they're the things that Kenny loves. He loves people to kind of think on their feet and be spontaneous with it and alter things as you see fit. There's been some short corners that were taken just spontaneously as well. But like I say, a lot of them are what Kenny comes up with. And then obviously he has to have people that can bring that to the table and kind of make it happen. And sometimes you'll see that maybe, like, and I've done it myself this season, where the delivery's not been what you would want it to be. And it's just about getting the percentages high and delivering the ball where it should go, or playing a short pass where it should go, making the right run, right movement at the right time. So yeah, a lot of it comes from his thinking. But what I will say is, Chris Long's goal from the edge of the box was something that I did come up with. But no, it wouldn't be possible if they wasn't the type of coaches that are willing to let you have that input. So it's something that I mentioned, that Longy's free kick, and they were really on board with it and just said, yeah, that's great. So yeah, it's nice to be involved in that kind of environment where it's not all about, do what the coaches say. Be spontaneous, come up with ideas, give us ideas, we'll give you ideas, and everyone's kind of singing from the same hymn sheet, really.
So when Longy scored that free kick and you're all pointing at the bench, it wasn't a case of, well done, you came up with that. It was a pointing at them and saying, see, we told you this would work.
Yeah, well, to be honest, the first time I mentioned it, I remember the gaffer saying, oh yeah, that's good, that, like, we'll use that, we'll have some of that, and Kenny the same. And then we'd practice it weeks before, but we just never got the free kick in the right position. And although I hadn't been successful up to that point with my free kicks, I'm always backing myself to score a free kick. Like, I've scored quite a few, like, over the years, and sometimes it's in a position where you feel like, you know, you don't really want to mess around with it. You just want to hit the shot and you think you can score. But that one was more set up for, I feel as though when it's a little bit too close, it's difficult to get up and over the wall, and you can kind of move it around a little bit and get someone who strikes the ball really cleanly, obviously Longy, getting pretty much a free shot from the edge of the box. So yeah, it was more a case of, like, you know, thanks for letting me kind of have my input, and it's worked out well. Not so much like, oh, I told you so. It was more a case of, look, you know, like, I thought it would work, and it has worked. So they was as buzzing as I was at that moment, I think.
So just on this then, I'm curious to know like how many you've got. Is it like an NFL quarterback where you've got like a whole playbook of set piece moves, or do you have like two or three that you've worked on and you think you've got a good chance of pulling them off for a particular opponent, or is it just purely a case of where the free kick is from and where how the opposition's set up?
Yeah, I think it kind of depends on, you know, sometimes you might do a specific corner on the first corner because you're more likely to catch someone out. Everyone would expect that, you know, the first corner is going to be one that you put in the box, test them out and see how they deal with a delivery. But more often than not, the first corner will catch people out. So we've had like an array of different ones we've done, and the ones that have been successful, obviously, then you keep, and the ones that don't really kind of work out, you need to do a bit of extra work on. And it's also like varying them and spreading them out because teams get a gist of what you might do. There are some that are worked with like blocks, and they're pretty much ones that you can't really stop. So them ones kind of seem to stay in. And then every so often you get a referee that's a little bit more busier, if you like, and might spot a block and you don't get away with it. But we had a few that have worked with blocks and things like that, so they seem to stay within like the resume, if you like. But yeah, Kenny's kind of coming up with new ideas all the time. But it's also difficult as well, because when you've got people like Conor Reardon, people like Mickey Demetriou, who actually get on the end of just delivering a ball in the box, it's difficult to kind of get it right in terms of how many you actually deliver into the box, how many you play short. And we've been successful from both sides of that. But ultimately, like, you know, delivering a ball, good delivery, you need people that really have the desire to get on the end of things. And we've got that this season with a couple of the lads. So the other ones are just little additional ones, really, that can kind of catch a team up.
And then just one last question on set pieces. You know, what we see from the stand is the old one hand for front post, two hand for back post. You know, is there more to it than that? Have you got all little like code words and buzzwords and body language?
Don't give it away, though, Jack. Don't give it away.
Yeah, no, it's usually more just like, you have to kind of think a lot more than that. In a sense, it might just be like, we'll say the second corner of the game, or the first outswinger, or this, that. Like, we don't use so much signals here, really. That's just more of a timing thing, like putting your hand up and just seeing when the ball's going to be delivered. So it's more about the number of corners that you kind of accumulate and just being ready for that particular corner. Or sometimes just even having a bit of a conversation with one particular player. And sometimes that's all you need, really.
Jack, can I move the conversation on now to your midfield partner? I think Joel Tabana is probably the one who you've played most with. It seemed to me, probably to other Crewe fans from watching from the outside, that it seemed to click quite quickly with the two of you. Was that the case for you? Is it just, you know, two players that understand how to play football and, you know, is it nice to have someone on that level?
Yeah, I'd say so. It's a strange one, really. I think initially in pre-season, we probably set up to be more of a 4-3-3. And obviously a player that I've known for years in Charlie Colquitt, coming through obviously some injury problems that he had last year, was hopeful and obviously still hopeful to kind of prove himself and be able to get a run of games that he would require to really show his quality. So throughout pre-season, it was probably more me, Charlie Colquitt and Tabs, with them two in front of me, because at the time Connor Thomas was experiencing some issues with his calf. So that's the way it looked like it was going to be set up. And then obviously Charlie, unfortunately, had some more injury issues. And then it ended up being me and Joel as like a midfield two, really, with either a number 10 or two number 10s in front and a striker. And I just think it was a case of obviously the natural balance, having a right foot and a left foot. But I'd like to think me personally can do a little bit of both sides of the game, and then that allows Joel to be a good player in possession of the football. I kind of, not necessarily similarities because we're different types of players, but in terms of him being a central midfield player, much like I was at his age, is, like I mentioned earlier, is about learning the defensive side of the game and making sure that you're contributing in that sense. Because Joel will run around for you all day long. He's got great legs. He's got great energy. He can really drive the team forward. And for him, because he's a more natural attacker, probably played in more advanced positions in his youth football, him developing as a central midfield player will come with games in terms of being in the right place at the right time, making interceptions, making tackles. But as such a willing footballer, really, someone who really loves football, has got a good brain. And I just think it works well because I like to think we can both handle the football. We both work hard. And then between the two of us, we always hope we can do our fair share of our defensive duties. So yeah, it just seemed to work well. I just think it was more a case of I say it a lot, some people you play with and it just clicks naturally, and then some people it takes a little bit more time, but it just kind of clicked. And being the type of team that we want to be, being able to handle the ball between the two of us, just kind of made it work.
I'd say Joel Taverner has improved quite a lot this year in lots of different aspects, but I would say his defensive play is one of the big things that he's took a big step forward in. So, you know, there's a possibility you've had a big role in that. Do you see, and you know, with the possibility of upsetting you or reminding you of this, you're about a month away from turning 30, I believe. So do you see your role now as an elder statesman in helping these young players develop? Because Joel Taverner is not the only youth player we've got playing in the first team. I mean, I think that's a bit of an understatement at the moment, the amount of youth players in and around the first team squad. Is that something you're conscious of as, you know, helping these young pros getting along?
Yeah, I think, to be honest, it was part of the reason why I came to club in the first place. Over the last sort of 2 or 3 years, I've seen myself become that kind of more experienced, more of a leadership type role within any dressing room that I've been in. Someone that kind of really enjoys football and studies football, analyses football, and wants to help people improve. So yeah, I'd like to think so. I'd like to think that all the young lads know that I'm there to talk to when they need it, and I'm quite willing to go and talk even if they don't need it or want it. Do you know what I mean? So it's something that I quite enjoy. And just trying to drop into them when I can, little bits of advice and stuff just from experience where I feel as though my career might have altered with certain experience, with certain advice. So yeah, like, I'm keen for them boys to do really well. We've got a really good kind of crop of youngsters that have come through. So it's something I do see in myself. I feel like I've always had it within me, but as you get older and you get more experience, you're more comfortable in speaking up and giving advice to people through your experiences.
It sounds like you've got some quite strong ideas on player development. And you mentioned that you probably should have gone and played earlier in your career than you actually did when you went on loan, and you've obviously talked about the development of some of the youngsters at Crewe. Is that something you see yourself getting into after your playing career, that sort of, you know, sort of player development or coaching?
Yeah, I'd like to think so. I think if the opportunity arose, it's something that I'd love to do. I just think I have so much love for the game, regardless of the good and the bad, really, that I see myself staying in the game, really. I think coaching, managing, whatever it might be, is something that I'd like to try my hand at. And again, another part of the reason why I come to Crewe, like, it's a club that does that and is willing to help people do that. Obviously, for me, I'd like to think it's in the distant future still. Still got a lot playing in me, but it's something that I always think about. Something that I kind of think about daily, really, in terms of the way that I sort of approach people and give them advice. And I think a lot of things now, like with young players, is just when I mentioned it at the beginning, offline, if you like, about nothing's personal. And I think that's a good thing to live by in football. You know, people might want to give you, not advice in the wrong way, but they might want to give you a bit of a rollicking, really. And it's all for the benefit of the team. And I think the best thing for young players to do is recognize that and realize that. So I think as well, like, I kind of came through in football in a different era, in a way, where when I trained with the first team at West Ham and when I first started with Millwall, it was kind of like, you know, you can't step out of line in any way, and they don't necessarily help you, because I've had players along the years that have helped me, but it's quite cutthroat, if you like. Nowadays, things seem to be a little bit different, but if you can kind of take something from them times and learn that kind of things are not personal, and people just want the best for each other, then I think that's how, like, youngsters will will improve a lot in a short space of time when they're trying to improve a lot in a short space of time in order to be consistent in men's football.
Can we just sort of go back into the sort of like the leadership role? I think you were saying that you would see it as part of your role to give advice, give, you know, little bits of piece of information that maybe you would have wanted. What does the leadership role look like in that first team dressing room? Obviously, Luke Offord is the captain. From an outsider watching the game, he doesn't seem a shouter. He sort of like is very much a, this is how I'm going to play. I expect you to play at this level. And then I think, would I be right in saying Mickey is a leader as well?
Yeah, definitely. I think, to be honest with you, I don't think we've got many screamers and shouters. And I think, like I say, like my era of coming through, there was more of those screamers and shouters around. And it's probably, in a way, probably dying out of the game. The screamers and shouters is not really a thing anymore. It's more of a lead by example type thing. Give information to people. Obviously, you get the odd occasion where, you know, someone raises their voice and we'll have a scream and a shout, but it's not like that's the solution to much nowadays. It's more of a case of, you know, giving the right information at the right time. Mickey and Offord do that well. None of us as leaders, I would say, are really big screamers and shouters on or off the pitch, but it's more of a lead by example and give good, clear information when you feel like it's necessary. And also, you know, give someone a kick up the when they need it as well. And that's happened on a few occasions this season. That's something that I feel like I can sort of, I do both and just kind of choose when I feel like the right one is to use, if you like. So yeah, we've got a few leaders in the dressing room in there and more so players that just lead by example and give good information when they feel like it's necessary.
I'm led to believe that that's the way Lee Bell likes to manage as well. He says quite often that he's not really a shouty, sweary, throwing teacups around the dressing room manager. It's more of a, this is what we need to do to fix the problem we've got ourselves in.
Yeah, definitely. I'd say that, like, I've played with managers in the past that can be quite personal and, you know, have a go at a player or even myself at times where, like, it's more of, like, a personal thing. It's like, you this, you that, and you better liven up and all that kind of stuff. And it gets a certain reaction from most people and they want to prove that that's not the case. But most of the time now, like, especially with our gaffer as well, that like, it's just more clear information on how to improve. Or if it's generally just someone needs a bit of a G up, it can be quite... not aggressive, I'd say, but it can be, you know, the gaffer would never like get in someone's face or anything like that, but it will give you clear instruction that you need to improve. So yeah, he kind of manages that really well. And obviously you can see up until, I'd say, probably a slight blip that we're having at the moment, it's worked out to be successful.
Now, in a minute, Tim's got some quiz questions for you, Jack, so I hope you're ready. I've got a question, and you're more than welcome to say, I don't want to answer that one. Yep. I constantly change my opinion on the answer to this. Which one of the current crop of academy players coming through do you think's got the highest ceiling at the club?
The highest ceiling at the club or in football?
As in their career, at their club now and then
in their career?
Yeah.
That's a tough one, that. I can understand why you change it quite regularly. That is tough. I'd say probably...
If it helps, I can give you my current feeling. My current feeling is Conor O'Riordan.
Yeah, I'd probably go with the same, to be honest with you. Just because of, you know, I feel like, you know, you've got the likes of Joel Tabernacle, you've got the likes of Rio Adebisi, who's done really well this season. Offord, obviously, now is a bit older, but I've really enjoyed playing with him this season. Has done really well and would surprise me if at some point in his career he went on and played at a higher level. But yeah, those lads, and then you've got the younger lads like, you know, Lunty and Mata Solacek, and then you've got Kalamagius coming through from the youth team at the moment. Probably a few more that I haven't named. But I think Connor, with the way that the modern day game is and his attributes, and, you know, having a lot of size but being able to run and having a lot of size but being able to play, I think just so many football clubs at whatever point in his career will be interested in what he can bring to the table. And I think there's been games where time and time again, I even obviously watched a game against Warsaw, and I just think that he shows that he's got that touch of class that the higher levels would be after at some point. So at this moment, I'd have to say Conor Reardon, but to be honest, like older than that, that I mentioned, it wouldn't surprise me if they went on and played at a higher level in their career.
Yeah, before I get on to these questions, you mentioned a number of the younger lads there who are, you know, a lot of the kind of wingers or forward players, quite skillful. And it reminded me of something you said about how football's changed since the days when you were at Millwall and West Ham. Do you still have the opportunity to boot them up in the air if they get too cocky in training, some of these young kids, or is that not acceptable these days?
Yeah, I've to be honest, it doesn't happen nowhere near as much as it what it used to when I used to train with like first teams being a youngster, to be honest. And it doesn't get spoken about as much as it used to be either. And to be honest, most of them are probably a little bit too quick for me to kick up in the air. But yeah, that's not my style. Like, I'll leave that kind of stuff to Luke Offord and maybe Dimitri, really. Luke Offord's probably the most likely to kick you in training. But yeah, no, I am such a good group of players coming through. And the thing that I've mentioned to people as well, like aside from the question a little bit, the great thing that I found being at Crewe is that coming through, obviously, in other youth setups at Millwall and West Ham, them clubs are always looking for the outstanding talent. And that might only be one or two. The thing with Crewe is that, you know, you might not necessarily, they've got a crop now coming through, and not all of those players, although they may, will, it's more than likely not all of them will go on to be outstanding footballers, but can they do a good job in League Two, in League One? They can. And it's been proven, obviously, this season with the amount of youngsters that we've used, and hopefully the amount of youngsters that we continue to use, that, you know, you see it a lot now with clubs that have a big turnaround of players every year. And it could happen at Crewe in the near future, who knows? But they'll bring in players almost to do a job, if you like. But why not give that opportunity to youngsters that can do a similar job? So I think the great thing about Crewe is that it's not necessarily that you've got to be an outstanding talent to get an opportunity. But if, you know, you're willing to work hard and you can do a good job for the team, why bring in someone else from the outside who can just do a good job when you can do one yourself? So that's a great thing I've found at Crewe, and that's not something that I've ever seen in football before, to be honest with you. And obviously part of the reason why they're able to bring through so many players, because until you get the opportunity, no one really knows whether you're capable of taking it or not.
Exactly, exactly. Excellent. Well, you mentioned a few of your teammates, so there's a few questions here, so I'd be interested to see what answers you give about some of them. So we'll start with, who is the best in training?
Best in training, I'd probably have to go with probably me, I reckon.
good answer.
I really enjoy training, and I like to think that I put my all into training and I train well. But if I had to pick one of the players, I'd probably say Joel Tabernard, because a lot of the time, although like we do a great job for a living and we all really enjoy it and there's nothing else we'd rather do, when you're playing so many games, you're conscious of like your energy levels and things like that. And Joel has just got bundles of energy and he just loves football and he's always on the move. So he's always someone that you want in your seven-a-side team. But in terms of catching the eye and just doing a bit of magic now and again, you've got people like Charlie Colquitt who can do ridiculous things with a football. And some lads that probably are on the opposite side of that, who just turn up on game day.
Naturally leads on to the next question, which is, who's the worst in training?
I told him this himself, to be fair, but if I was picking a five-a-side or a seven-a-side team, Courtney Baker Richardson would be absolutely miles away from it.
Who's the most likely to turn up on Love Island?
Oh, that's a tough one. Love Island. Oh, that's easy, actually. Courtney Baker Richardson. I don't know if you know this, but he's always got his top off. I don't know if you noticed it, but
I was surprised that took you so long to answer. That was my immediate.
Yeah, to be honest, I didn't think. Do you know what? Initially, I thought Joel, like a good-looking lad, but he's not really that type, to be fair. But Courtney, I know that Courtney would probably never ever go on it, but in the way that he carries himself with the muscles and all that, that you can imagine him on there.
Who's got the best dress sense?
Best dress sense. To be honest, not many of the lads make an effort. I'll be honest with you. They don't make an effort.
Club trackies all round.
No, I'm the most smartly dressed person, and I'd like to think that all the lads would say that it would be me. But if I had to choose one of the other lads, and I'd sound like as if I'm picking myself for everything here, but one of the other lads, it's really hard because I don't think I've ever seen anyone actually dress smartly.
Those pictures from the club night out a couple of weeks ago don't really help either with this question, do they?
Everyone wears similar gear, to be honest. That's why I like it when someone goes for something a little bit unique. I'd probably say I like some of the stuff that Shiloh wears, some of the stuff that Aaron Rowe wears, Charlie Colquitt. But to be honest with you, no one really springs to mind when you talk about best dress. And what it's about... more so because no one makes much of an effort, to be honest with you.
So what about going the other way in the worst dress sense?
Oof, worst. Based on our Christmas do, I'd probably go with Tom Booth. Someone said that he was wearing a pair of his mum's jeans. So there you go.
And worst car?
Worst car. I'm not really one for slating people's cars, to be honest, but because I'm a bit of an, you know, I'm not old school, but I just think A to B does the job, do you know what I mean? But who's got the worst car? No, I think Offord just got himself a new car. But before then, for someone that's played an awful lot of league football and hopefully looked after his money, I think he was driving around in a little Renault, I think, when I first joined the club. So I'll go with Luke Offord because that's the only one I can think of.
Fair play. Who can do the most keep-ups?
I think if you've done a keep-up competition, I think Charlie Colquitt would win. Charlie Colquitt, Joel Tabernard, any of the young lads really, I think, have been brought through at Crewe. Like, it's kind of all about the ball, isn't it? I think any of the young lads, but I honestly think that probably Charlie Colquitt would have been that, yeah.
Who can do the fewest?
who can do the fewest kick-ups? If I had to guess, I'd probably say either Mickey or Courtney. Or Booby. Watching them three have a keep-up competition, I think it would be quite entertaining, to be fair.
it wouldn't take long, from the sound of it. So, who's the fastest?
Shiloh. Easy.
Who's the slowest?
I reckon it's me, in the squad. But if it was one of the teammates, probably me and Mickey.
Who's the strongest? Who can lift the most?
Courtney, I reckon. Courtney or Rio, maybe.
And last one. Who would you least like to be stuck on a desert island with?
Actually, last one, Nevitt's really strong. Elliot Nevitt, strong lad. If he actually, like, if we, because we're not doing, like, so much, like, heavy-weighted gym work regularly because of all the games and stuff. Like, if he put his mind to it, he'd be one of the strongest lads, definitely. Desert island, least likely to be on a desert island with?
Least, the one you'd least like to be stuck on an island with.
Tough one. I'd probably say Ryan Cooney. And the reasons are I'm not sure what he'd bring to the table. I'm not sure what he'd bring to the table. We could have a chat, no problem. We have good chats now and again, but I'm not sure he'd entertain me. I'm not sure he'd save me from any sort of like deadly animals. I'm not sure if he'd be able to catch some food, find water. More to do with the fact that I don't think he's the brainiest. He's the brainiest of our squad. So I'd go with someone with a bit more brains than Ryan Cooney, I think.
Brilliant. Well, thanks for that, Jack. Hopefully that's given everyone a good insight into some of your teammates. Thank you.
No worries.
All right, just getting back to the football then, really, really briefly. Something that I noticed was, and this is something you can take to Lee Bell when you are back and fit and playing. First four games of the season, you were subbed off at various stages of the game. The fifth game of the season, home to Walsall, the first game you finished 90 minutes. 90th minute, your only goal for Kralix at this stage. So, you know, that is just something that I'm going to give you to give to Lee Bell and, you know, say, use
I'll
this if you want.
Don't worry.
Yeah. But to be honest with you, Jack, I think we've taken up more than enough of your time there. You've been a superb with us, jumping on and talking to us for so long. I think what I'll just finish by saying is, you know, from Tim and I and every crew fan listening, we can't wait to get you back on the pitch and, you know, hope the recovery goes well and keeps going as well as it has done. But thank you so much for coming on today.
No problem. I appreciate you having me and I can't wait to get back out there as well. So I look forward to that.
And then it all sounds like you're gearing yourself up to follow in the footsteps of Kenny Lund, Lee Bell, all the ex-crew players that have gone on to finding their coaching badges at crew and then carrying on that way as well. So, yeah, thank you, Jack, for coming on today. Thank you, Tim, as well.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. We'll be back on Monday. Until then, goodbye. Bomb, 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 bomb